professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Why is your support so important? Because this station relies on listeners for nearly one out of every $2 it spends to bring you programs. Since detailed analysis and objective reporting is important to you, please renew your WILL membership now. Mail your check today or give online at willpledge.org. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. I think probably one of the best known, arguably one of the best known conflicts of the ancient world would be the Trojan War. There are a lot of people who will know some of the basics of the story, and I think probably almost everyone will have heard the story of the horse, the Trojan horse, the ruse that the Greeks used to get into Troy and to sack the city and eventually to win the war. Now, for a lot of people, a lot of scholars, it's a matter of myth, perhaps a very important myth to the ancient Greeks, but a myth nonetheless. This morning, however, we'll be talking with an historian who says that if you take a look at particularly some of the recent archaeological evidence, there is good reason to conclude that there actually was a city, Troy did exist, it was a large and powerful city, and that there was a war or a series of battles, maybe not exactly as it has come down to us from Homer, but enough like it so that we should believe that, in fact, it did occur and that Homer was essentially building on events that did actually happen when he crafted his great work, the Iliad. Our guest this morning is Barry Strauss. He's professor of history and classics at Cornell University. He has done a lot of research in Greece and Turkey looking into this subject. He has been interviewed on many historical programs and documentaries, and he is the author of a new book. It's titled The Trojan War, A New History. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's out now, and you might want to take a look at it. Questions are also welcome as we talk this morning with Barry Strauss. He's joining us by a high-quality audio connection here, an ISDN connection coming to us from Cornell. And we also want to thank the folks at the Cornell University Press Office and Bert Reed, who's the engineer there. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can give us a call. Professor Strauss, thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
The essence of the story here that comes from Homer, I think people maybe will know the precipitating event here, concerns what might have been a kidnapping or might have been a seduction. I guess it sort of depends upon whose version you read. But we have a woman named Helen who was said to be the most beautiful woman in the world. She lived with her husband Menelaus in Sparta, and a prince named Paris from Troy comes on a diplomatic mission, and he sets eyes on Helen and promptly falls in love with her, and either kidnaps her or persuades her to go with him. They go back to Troy, taking a good deal of the treasure belonging to her husband, and her husband's not real happy about this, and persuades his brother and some of the other local warlords, perhaps we would call them at the time, to all gather together, gather up their soldiers, and go to teach Paris a lesson and get Helen back. That's sort of the basic story, and we can talk about, you know, some of the other things. Is there, first of all, I guess the question, is there good reason to believe that there was such a city and that it was an important city and it was a wealthy city, and it would have been a place that would have been a good prize for the Greeks to think about taking?
Yes. There have been archaeologists excavating at a site in northwestern Turkey since Schliemann in 1871. And up until the 1990s, they had found a citadel about a half acre in size that was fortified by some of the most impressive walls we have from the ancient world. What's changed since then is that the excavators have now found the lower city outside the citadel. And they have shown that this was not a city that was a half acre in size, but a city that was 75 acres in size, which much better fits the picture we get in Homer of a large and wealthy city.
Is there some estimate of how many people might have lived in Troy at the time?
Well, I think we could say there's a guesstimate. We really don't know. By modern standards, it was tiny, perhaps on the order of 5,000 people, maybe as many as 7,000 people, but maybe as few as 3,000 people. But we're talking about 1200 BC, so quite small by our standards, but large by the standards of the day.
Mm-hmm. I think probably when people now today think about ancient Greece, I expect they think about Golden Age Greece.
Yes.
And the Greece that we're talking about here, Bronze Age Greece, is actually hundreds of years before that. So it's not, this is not the Greece of the Parthenon that we're talking about. This is a different place.
Yes, it's much earlier. And in some ways, we're better off seeing it as part of the ancient Near East and thinking about the pyramids, Pharaoh, Mesopotamia. That's a world that in many ways is closer to the Bronze Age Greece.
Mm-hmm. Well, what at the time, would Greece have been like, or what would this place have been like?
Greece.
Yeah.
Greece would have been a series of kingdoms. You're quite right before when you spoke about them being ruled by warlords. These were kingdoms with a warrior elite. And each one would have a king or a chief, and there would be other warriors. The purpose of the kingdoms, in large part, was to make war, to go on raids. The Greeks had successfully, over the centuries, conquered the islands of the Aegean and had made war had landed in Anatolia, what is today Turkey, and had gone on a series of raids. In a few places, they had actually planted colonies. The most impressive of these is a place called Miletus, which is south of the modern city of Izmir. There are a whole lot of indices that show us, archaeological indices that show us the Greek presence in Anatolia.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of, in the story that comes to us from Homer, there are a lot of names that are very important. The warrior chiefs, princes who fought Helen, the leaders and the warriors in Troy. Is there reason to believe that these people, and we can talk about what we think might actually have happened and how that coalesced into the story about this epic war, but is there reason to believe that these people, Helen and Agamemnon and Menelaus and Achilles and Odysseus actually lived?
Yes, there are several reasons to believe they actually lived. For one thing, the names in Homer do not fit well with the names that we find in later classical Greece, the Greece of the Parthenon. However, they do fit very well with the names that we find in documents surviving from the Bronze Age. One name, for instance, Paris, who is the prince of Troy, he's also known in the Iliad as Alexander. And we've actually found a king of Troy called Alexandru, not necessarily our Paris, but it shows that this was a name in the royal house of Troy. Second reason to believe that these people existed is that we know that Homer was to some extent the product of an oral tradition over generations and centuries. And although there are many things that are difficult to remember over centuries, names are relatively easy to remember. And the third reason to think that these people actually existed is the way Homer describes them and the motives and behavior patterns he gives them do not fit classical Greece, but they do fit the way people behaved in the Bronze Age.
Hmm. Well, Paris, and again, as the way the story goes, Paris comes from Troy. Troy was already a place that was wealthy and important and powerful. So he was not a small individual in terms of his importance.
No.
So he comes to Sparta, sees Helen, and I guess we can not blame him if she was the most beautiful woman in the world for deciding mm-hmm. that he would like to have her as his wife. So he either persuades her to go with him or kidnaps her, one or the other, and they take whatever they can cart away of Menelaus' treasure. Why did he think that he could just do that? Just sort of waltz in there, steal the most beautiful woman, steal half the guy's stuff, and that the Greeks wouldn't do anything about it?
Well, he had reason to think that what the Greeks would do about it would be half-hearted. Mm-hmm. There had been precedents. We know of another war in the ancient world over a dynastic marriage gone bad. The circumstances were different, but it was a dynastic marriage between the Egyptians and the strongest power in what is today Turkey. They were called the Hittites. And the Hittite prince was murdered when he went to Egypt to marry an Egyptian queen. What did the Hittites do? They did the equivalent of lobbing a few cruise missiles over the border. They sent a small expedition to bloody the Egyptians, but they were not willing to put the effort in for a major war. And we can well imagine Paris thinking that the Greeks would do something similar. They'd make some gesture to show their displeasure and to save face, but Troy, after all, was defended by incredibly good defensive system. And it was easier to imagine the Greeks would be pests and annoyance than that they would actually be able to bring Troy down.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Barry Strauss. He's professor of history and classics at Cornell University. He has written or edited 8 books, most recently one looking at one of the most famous, perhaps the most famous naval battles of the ancient world, the Battle of Salamis. And we talked about that book a couple of years ago when it came out. And he lives in Ithaca, so where else, of course, are you going to live if you talk about the Trojan War? His new book is The Trojan War, A New History, published by Simon & Schuster. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Well, as we've said, I think we could understand that Menelaus would be unhappy and would want his wife back and his treasure, and maybe not necessarily in that order. So he goes to his brother, Agamemnon, to ask him for help in organizing the expedition to go and recover his wife and his treasure. Now, we can understand that Agamemnon might feel some obligation to his brother, but their fellow warlords, why would they put themselves, their lives, their fortunes, their soldiers on the line? Why would they have not said, well, tough break, Menelaus, old boy, get yourself another wife?
Well, I think there'd be several reasons. First of all, honor among thieves. These were all princes. They had all come to power in various ways, and it probably didn't make any of them look good to see one of the greatest of them humiliated in this manner and to see his power on the throne become shaky. No doubt they were tied by oaths and obligations to each other. But the third reason, I think, would be the promise of loot. Troy was a wealthy place, and the Greeks, as I said, were in the habit of going abroad and looking for loot. So the idea of some kind of expedition to Troy, perhaps not one that would actually conquer and sack the city, but some kind of expedition to Troy would have a certain amount of appeal.
And I don't know if we actually did mention some dates. There are, of course, some wiggle room in here. But if we'd say when approximately do we think that these events took place?
Approximately 1200 BC.
And when does Homer come along and tell the story that now has come to us as Iliad and Odyssey?
Approximately 700 BC.
So there's 500 years between actual events and Homer. So to the Greeks, this was, well, I don't know if they would think that it was ancient history, but it was the events were hundreds of years before. And no doubt, though, people were telling stories about this probably for all that time. And that's where Homer gathered up everything that he would take and then eventually weave together into the Iliad.
Yes. I mean, we, after all, talk about the founders of the American Republic as if it were yesterday. It's so relevant to us. It wouldn't be difficult to imagine the Greeks thinking back to these great warriors of earlier generations and their epic movements across the Aegean in conquest and adventure. It wouldn't be difficult to imagine the Greeks wanting to look back at this.
And as far as they were concerned, this would not be a matter of myth. They believed that these events actually did happen, essentially as the story has come to us.
Well, you know, it's interesting that throughout antiquity, to a man or to a woman, because in fact, woman poets talk about it as well, the Greeks believed the Trojan War really did happen. Now, they disagreed about some of the details of it. In fact, some ancient authors say, Trojan horse, give me a break. War for Helen? I don't think so. They were in it for the loot. Mm. But nobody ever doubted that the Trojan War really happened.
We have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation. Let us do that. And we'll start with someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. I'm listening to this, and I know I don't have a real comprehensive background in the history of the Bronze Age in Greece, but I know of certain places. And I was wondering, you threw out a fact that Troy, they have found the ruins of where Troy used to be?
They found the ruins of Troy, yes. Yes.
And you said that between 5,000 and 7,000 people lived there. Could you kind of give me a fuller perspective? And at that same time, did Athens exist? How many people lived there? How many people lived in Sparta? Maybe how many people lived in, I don't know if Thessaloniki was even a city at that time. And how far away were they from all of this and the general geography of this vicinity?
Well, that's an excellent question. Some of those cities did exist. Athens existed. I don't think Thessaloniki did. Sparta actually as a city didn't exist, but there was a city in what later would become Sparta. Mycenae existed. Thebes existed. The biggest of these cities, such as Mycenae, were probably in a similar ballpark to Troy, possibly not quite as big, but they were impressive places as well.
How many people do you guess? I don't want to dilute the conversation, but in relation to the city of Troy, the kingdom of Troy, so to speak, how many people were living in some of these other places, and how far would it take them to get? They were all traveling over the water rather than on land to get to Troy?
Well, we don't know how many people are living in these places, but I don't think the figures would, for the biggest of them, let us say Mycenae, I don't think you would find Mycenae to be radically smaller than the population there to be radically smaller than the population in Troy. I think it'd be in a similar ballpark. As far as how you would get from Greece to Troy, by far the best way to travel is by sea.
Uh-huh.
And that's true of throughout antiquity because the road network in the ancient world was terrible. And motive power was very expensive. It was much cheaper and easier to move by ship because to a certain extent you could depend on winds. And it was cheaper and easier to feed men as rowers than to feed beasts of burden. So for those reasons, it'd be much better to travel by sea.
And all of this history that you're discussing today, long, long before Alexander the Great.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Remember that, you know, documented history goes back to well before this, to the middle of the third millennium BC. We can actually talk about documented wars that took place in, say, 2300 BC. And through archaeology, we can even point to cities and conflicts much, much earlier than that. A conflict as early as 3500 BC and at least large town life thousands of years before that. So what might seem very early to us, in fact, is not so early from the point of view of human history.
Are any of these city-states, even though they're their own states, their own kingdoms, are they starting to share in some of the theology, some of the polytheism that we've heard of all the different gods that the Athenians believed in? Were we seeing any similarities in Troy?
Yes, we can. Well, we can certainly trace the Greek gods back to the Bronze Age, and we do see similarities between the gods in Troy and in Anatolia in generally and the gods in Greece. It's clear that there was a certain amount of borrowing back and forth.
How about their languages? What are they speaking? Each individual city-state probably has its own language?
That is a tough question. We don't know exactly what the Trojans were speaking. A good guess is that they were speaking a language called Luvian, and that Luvian, this is not a guess, we know that Luvian is related to Hittite, and Hittite is the language of the major power of ancient Anatolia. Another guess is that there undoubtedly were people at Troy who also spoke Greek, because we know there are a lot of trade connections between the Greeks and Troy. And the picture we get in Homer of Trojan kings having and princes having two names, a Trojan name like Paris and a Greek name like Alexander, that would very much fit a city that had trade connections both east and west.
How far are these are the folks from Troy having to go? Once again, I'm kind of ignorant here. Over the water to get to
several hundred miles.
Oh, just okay, but it's under 1,000 and
yes,
more than 500.
No, I think it's closer to 500.
Oh, okay, this is neat.
John?
Keep going.
Well, thanks for the call. Just a quick point here. I think that you, one of the things you point out in the book is that for a long time there were some scholars who felt that the Trojans were Greeks. And
yes,
you say that, in fact, no, the Trojans were not Greek. They were ethnically, they were different people.
It's likely. Again, there may have been some Greeks living in Troy. I think it's likely that there were Greeks living in Troy. But there are reasons to think that the basic stock, if you will, the basic culture of the city was not Greek. And the reasons have to do with the urban planning and the architecture, particularly things that we found in the latest excavations. They fit the pattern of an Anatolian city better than that of a Greek city. Furthermore, one of the reasons why some early scholars, and not all, but some early scholars thought the Trojans were Greek was because of the large amount of Greek-style pottery found at Troy. Well, two things about that. First, that has to be put in perspective. By far, the majority of pottery found at Troy is not Greek-style. It's Anatolian-style. And second, we now know through tests of the clay that was used in this pottery is that this was not pottery imported from Greece. It was pottery made in Anatolia in imitation of the Greek style. So Greek cultural influence, artistic influence, absolutely. But the actual handiwork was done in Troy and not necessarily by Greek speakers.
We're at our midpoint here. Our guest, as I mentioned, is Barry Strauss. He's professor of history and classics at Cornell. He's author of The Trojan War, A New History. It's published by Simon and Schuster. And we have some other callers here. We'll talk next with someone in Urbana on line two. Hello.
Hello. How would you compare the Greeks of this period to, say, the Vikings of 800 or 900 A.D.? Was their culture somewhat similar?
Well, there was some similarity. In fact, in the book, I call the Greeks the Vikings of the Bronze Age because, like the Vikings, they were experts at shipbuilding. In fact, the Greeks probably built the first galleys, the first dedicated warships that we know of. They were experts at the sea. And like the Vikings, they went on raids. They were traders. They often were not very strict about the distinction between trading and raiding. A trading mission could turn into a raiding mission and vice versa. Their kingdoms, however, were probably more organized than some of the earlier Viking kingdoms, and there were probably more among the Greeks warfare was run from the center than we would find among the Vikings. There probably was less local initiative among the Bronze Age Greeks than we find
a little more like, say, the Vikings of 1,000 or 1,200 A.D. when they set up the Kingdom of Sicily and established the feudal system.
Yes, that would be an analogy. But even earlier on, when the Vikings are sending the great army to England, I think there's some analogy between that and the Mycenaean Greeks, the Bronze Age Greeks.
The Trojans, if they were related to the Hittites, that would be another rather distantly related Indo-European people then.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And there are many indications of peoples in Western Anatolia who were related to the Hittites linguistically and no doubt ethnically as well.
Have we finally discovered what happened, what caused the collapse of the Hittite empire?
No. I mean, this is it's a very exciting area of research, and it's something that's still being investigated. We now know that earlier generation, we thought that the Hittite capital city was going along strong, and then one day, boom, invaders come and it's destroyed. We now know that the city was in crisis for a generation, that it was being depopulated, that it had many problems before it finally fell. And we now can see that there were dynastic conflicts among the various Hittite kings and princelings that contributed to the Hittite decline, the Hittite fall. It was not simply a matter of a foreign invasion that brought it down at a stroke. But the precise picture, we don't have that yet.
Interesting subject. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you.
You're very
Let's
welcome.
Let's go to Belgium, another caller here nearby, line number four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Earlier in your conversation, you mentioned that Homer lived in an oral history type situation. Now, the question I have for you, well, couldn't the aspect of the Trojan Wars actually be somewhat of a parable, especially the aspect of the Trojan Horse, trying to point out orally that there are sometimes prices to be paid for war, you know what I mean? You might be confused when you think you win, when you lose, you know what I mean? Could that actually be the aspect of the Trojan Horse story?
Yes, that's a good point. It might well be a parable. But there are two things I would say that might make us think somewhat differently about it. First of all, although Homer was writing in an oral tradition, excuse me, composing in an oral tradition and might indeed not have had writing at all when he composed the poem, it's very likely that he lived in Anatolia, in what is today Western Turkey, and there writing did not disappear. There were written documents, and although he wouldn't be able to read them, he could certainly speak to people who had access to written documents that might give them a more accurate picture of what had happened to Troy. Second thing to keep in mind about the Trojan horse is that while the horse itself might be a little hard to believe in, the tactic that it describes, that is, tricking the people of Troy and getting them to think that the Greek army had left when in fact it was waiting nearby to pounce on the Trojans. This tactic is well documented in Bronze Age warfare, in historical documents. We see Hittite commanders and Mesopotamian commanders using similar tactics. So I don't think it's completely a parable. I think that it is rooted in military reality, even though the horse itself, well, perhaps that has a mythic element to it.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, it's a good story, that's for sure.
It is a great story.
Danville next, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Homer has given us a compelling tale of the last year of the war. Are there sources for the first 9 years? And also, before I have two more issues that I'd like for you to mention. Is there some evidence that there was a written language in the area and then it disappeared for quite a while? And the third thing, do you believe that Homer was one man who composed these stories?
Okay, those are three great questions. The first one was about the earlier years of the war. You're absolutely right. Homer, except for a few references, talks strictly about the last year of the war, or perhaps the ninth year of what he calls a 10-year war. There are other epic poems, none of which have survived in entirety, but each of which we have a little bit of. The Greeks had other epic poems, for instance, one called The Sack of Troy, which tell us some details about the earlier part of the war. Second question, was there writing in these areas? Yes, we have excellent evidence. In fact, we have thousands of documents. In Greece, for example, we have thousands of documents of an earlier form of the Greek language, written not in an alphabet, as we know the familiar Greek alphabet, but in a syllabary, a collection of syllables.
Oh.
It's called Linear B.
Oh, yes.
And we, We have a number of linear B texts from Greece of this period, none of which preserves any historical narrative. But nonetheless, they preserve a number of really fascinating facts from the point of view of Homer. We see some of the weapons he talks about, for instance, chariots. A lot of information about chariots, and chariots are not used in later Greek warfare. Some of the names that we get in Homer, like Hector, for instance, appears in these documents. There are also texts in Luwian. At Troy, we found just one text from the Bronze Age, and that's in Luwian. But there are other places where we found other texts in Luwian and in Hittite, so plenty of other languages. And I'm sorry, what was the third question?
Some people have thought that Homer was not a single individual. What is your view?
Right. Well, I think that the person who put the poems in their final shape was a single individual. But I think that Homer is not starting from scratch. This individual has the work of generations to go on. And I think that to have been a commercial success, as it were, to use a somewhat vulgar term, I think he would have had to been intimately familiar with this work, because I think what audiences would have wanted was to see someone who gives them something new, but not too new. He had to base it on the old stories, the classics. That's what people wanted. They wanted a connection to tradition. They wanted some connection to the past. So Homer, to be good at what he had did, could not have started from the beginning. He had to, as it were, depend on the committee that had gone before him.
And is it not in this oral tradition, were these not these performances, recitations over a period of 3 or 4 days even?
Quite possibly, yes. I mean, that's controversial, but that's quite a plausible suggestion.
I see. Well, thank you so much.
All right, thank
you're
you.
Welcome.
Let's go to someone on a cell phone. This is line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about the evidence for Troy being Troy. When Schliemann found the site, what kind of links were there between the site and the poem? And have those links been confirmed by subsequent archaeology?
Well, what Schliemann was going on was the indication in the poem that Troy is located at the entrance to the Dardanelles in northwestern Turkey. He had the help from other scholars who had looked at this mound called Hisarlik, a fortified place in Turkey. And he discovered there evidence of a great city, walls, a certain amount of gold, some of it questionable that Schliemann claims to have found. Other scholars excavating there have put what Schliemann found on a much more scientific footing. Around 1900, Schliemann's successor, a man named Dorpfeld, believed that he proved that he had found a great city with tremendous gates and walls, just as Homer described. The next excavator there, an American named Blagan, excavating in the 1930s and publishing his results in the 50s, came to different conclusions. He concluded that there was a Trojan War, but it corresponded to a different period in the history of Troy, and Troy was a city for thousands of years, and that Troy, at the time of the war, was really just a poor, decayed place, nothing like the grand city of Homer. And he concluded that Homer got it wrong, that this is glorifying myth, and that the real Trojan War was very petty, kind of like puppies fighting over a bone. What's so exciting about the new excavations of the 90s, largely the 90s, they're still continuing today, was that they showed that the original view was closer to the truth, and that Troy really was a big city, much closer to what Homer describes, and not the small, decayed, decadent place that Blagan thought he had found when he excavated there in the 30s. Another very interesting thing is that many, many of the geographic details in the Iliad and in the Odyssey are confirmed by archaeology. It's quite clear that Homer or whoever wrote the Iliad actually visited the ruins of Troy, and that what we're getting in the poem is a description of what we saw and what he saw or what they saw in those ruins. It's quite clear that they were at this particular place.
Thank you.
All right. And
you're welcome.
And we'll go again here to a caller here on line number 2, and this would be Urbana. Hello.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Good morning, Dr. Strauss.
Good morning.
Would you be so good as to take up the question of the introduction of slavery and the overthrow of the matriarchies by the Macedonian patriarchies in the Peloponnesian Peninsula? This is the thesis of the late Princeton University writer Julian Jaynes. His most famous book, of course, is The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. And this also weighs very heavily on the Peloponnesian Wars. Thank you for taking my call. I'll hang up and listen.
Sure. Great question. And here I'd have to plead that I'm just a simple historian and not as familiar with those theories as I might be. The evidence for matriarchy preceding patriarchy is fascinating. I don't think that it is good enough evidence, at least not yet, for us to put it in any kind of framework such as Jaynes did. But it's certainly clear that the mother goddess and female and goddesses were very, very powerful in the religion of Anatolia throughout antiquity, particularly in the Bronze Age, and not quite as powerful in the religions of Bronze Age Greece. So there is an element of male versus female, Greeks being from Mars, Anatolians being from Venus, if you will, in this period. But I don't think we can go so far as to say it's a war of patriarchy versus matriarchy. The evidence just doesn't support anything like that.
Our guest is Barry Strauss. He's professor of history and classics at Cornell University, author of The Trojan War, A New History, just recently published by Simon & Schuster. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. I wanted to talk for a bit here, give you a chance to talk about about the story of the war as Homer gives it to us and to sort of balance that with what we would know about warfare in the Bronze Age. Homer says, for example, that the Greek expeditionary force consisted of 1,184 ships. There were over Thucydides said he thought there could have been over 100,000 men on the Greek side, and the Trojan. Homer says that there were 50,000 on the Trojan side. We know that the numbers couldn't possibly be anything like that. What do you think would be a better sort of a guess as to the size of the forces that we're talking about?
Well, I think a more reasonable guess would be more like 15,000 men per side. And even that may be an exaggeration. I mean, what we know of armies in the Bronze Age and wars would speak for much smaller expeditions and a much smaller number of men and much smaller number of ships than Homer tells us. I mean, I suggest in my book that perhaps the Greek expedition consisted of as many as 300 ships. We don't know of any expeditions that large. In the Bronze Age, we do know of a powerful kingdom in what is today Syria that had 150 ships at its disposal. So if the Greeks were a coalition of kingdoms, perhaps they might have had as many as 300 ships as at their disposal. And 15,000 men would not be out of line for a coalition in Western Anatolia or a coalition of Greek city-states in this period, that we could imagine.
And Homer says this war takes 10 years. I think your conclusion is that that's maybe not likely only because the men who were fighting it, these warlords, the Greeks, probably would not have wanted to be away from their home bases that long. It would have presented a lot of problems for them if they truly had been gone from home for 10 years.
Well, certainly. And also, I think that Homer is using an expression from the ancient world. He says the war was fought for 9 years and won in the tenth. Mm-hmm. And we know from a number of different Bronze Age cultures that the expression nine and then a tenth is very much equivalent to our expression nine times out of ten, meaning, in other words, the vast majority, not literally nine in ten times. And I think Homer is using nine and ten as a way of saying a long time, but not literally 9 and 10 years. But even if he was talking about a 10 years war, we have to pay attention to the war as he describes it. You get the impression from the Iliad that we're talking about an intense war of enormous battles, of army versus army. But in fact, Homer, the Iliad is only about 51 days, and there are only 4 days of battle in the Iliad. Homer makes it clear that the rest of the war has not been like this. The rest of the war has been a low-intensity conflict, a series of raids. He also makes it clear that the Greeks never lay siege to the city of Troy, at least not in a technical sense. They never surround the city. They never build ditches around it, never build a palisade around it. They never cut it off from the rest of the world. We have to think of the Vikings here. The Greeks are more like the Vikings. They're encamped in Trojan territory, possibly 5 miles away from Troy. They caused lots of trouble for the Trojans, an endless amount of trouble. But what they're doing is much more desultory, much more low intensity than we might imagine. And so if you say, well, could the Vikings have been on raids in an area for a number of years? Sure. The Vikings did that sort of thing all the time.
Let's take another caller here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I have two questions. One is, you said that some women poets had mentioned the Trojan War in their sources. I only know of two Greek women poets. I was wondering if any of these Bronze Age or earlier women poets were named, or were they just fragments found?
Well, the best known Greek woman poet is Sappho, and she lived in the Archaic period, not the Bronze Age, so around 600 BC. We don't have many of her poems, but we have good portions of a number of them, and in more than one, she talks about Helen and the Trojan War. So, yes, she is named, and she is evidence that women poets talked about the Trojan War as well as male poets.
Oh, okay. The other question I had is, what, there may not have been a real Helen, but I wondered if there was some woman in Bronze Age history that, how can I say this? That Helen was based upon?
I'm glad you asked that. That's a great question. I think the chances are that there was indeed a woman who Helen was based upon. We don't know of any in Greece, but we do know of several powerful queens in the Near East, in Egypt, and in particular in the Hittite kingdom, what's now central Turkey, several powerful queens. One in particular, not a household name, I'm afraid, but known to ancient historians. Her name is Puduhepa. She lived around 1250 BC. She was a very powerful lady indeed. I mean, she had the right to make treaties under her own seal. She was enormously influential in the palace. In a sense, she was minister of religion, among other things. She educated the next generations. She is an example of the fact that queens were not necessarily shrinking violets in this period, but could be important, strong political players of their own. And so the picture we get of Helen as someone who was not ignorant of power and was capable of wielding it, I think that's quite credible in what we know about the Bronze Age.
I have one more question / observation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether Homer was really blind or not, but I once read an article that said he could not possibly have been because he used verbs of motion. Which I didn't buy that argument, but I was just curious if anybody knew for sure.
Well, I don't buy that argument either. I don't think we know if Homer was blind or not. It seems, for obvious reasons, unlikely. Or if he was blind, maybe he became blind late in life. It's a good story, and all good stories are always suspect to historians, but I think it's probably best to say, we don't know.
Thank you so much.
Right, thanks for the
You're
call.
Welcome.
I'd like to return for a bit to this, to the horse, to the
uh-huh.
story of the horse,
yes.
The thing that probably almost everybody knows, that story, that here,
right.
after fighting all of these many years, the Greeks have not been able to breach the walls, the very powerful walls that defend the city. So they're just about, yes, at the point where they're just going to have to give up and go home.
Right.
So someone comes up with this idea. They build this wooden horse and hide some soldiers inside, and then they go, then they leave. So the Trojans look out. They look out to the plain. They see the Greeks are gone, and there's this wooden horse. Mm-hmm. So there's this debate in the city what to do with it. Some people think, look, this is something about this isn't right. But basically, that most of the Trojans say, oh, this is a good thing. Let's bring it in the city. And, of course, at night when the Trojans are sleeping, the Greeks come out of the horse. They open the gates. Mm-hmm. Their comrades who have turned around and come back, come into the city. They sack the city, and that's the way they manage to win. And as we said, you know, it's a, whether it happened or not, it's a pretty good story. You say, though, that there's the technique of using tricks, certainly in Bronze Age warfare, was it was commonly done. I think you have a way of kind of thinking about how that it wasn't like Homer says it, but that it's possible you could imagine the Greeks doing something sort of like this, doing something to provide a major kind of distraction that would then allow them to find some way to sneak in and, sort of essentially do what the story says, if not in exact and precisely that way.
Yes, if we had a manual of the Bronze Age way of war, I'm convinced that it would have said, if you can't take a city by siege or by assault or by a series of raids that tire it out, use a trick. Because we find Bronze Age powers, such as the Hittites, doing precisely this when all other ways of taking a city fail. To me, the most important thing about the Trojan horse is less the horse itself than that the Greeks convince the Trojans that they are gone. Mm-hmm. That's the most important thing. The Trojans have to have their guard let down and not be expecting that the Greeks are there. I'm not all that invested in whether there are people inside the horse or not. I don't think it matters that much because in the Odyssey, I think it is, Homer tells us that before the Greeks left Troy, Odysseus disguised himself and snuck into the city. Well, if Odysseus was capable of sneaking into the city without a Trojan horse, then surely half a dozen Greeks were capable of sneaking into the city without a Trojan horse, and they could have opened the gates when on a signal when the Greeks had left. It's less important whether the gates were opened by people coming through the horse, coming from inside the horse or not, than whether the Trojans were tricked into thinking the Greeks were gone for good when really they were so close they could come back overnight. To me, that's the essence of the story.
So the idea, it would be perfectly plausible that a small number of Greek soldiers could have found some way of getting into the city and then essentially doing that thing when nobody was paying attention, opening up the gates, and that the Greeks who were just hiding over the horizon or, you know, whatever they did, were able to come back and that way storm the city.
Yes. And by the way, from better documented periods of ancient history, from the Roman period, we have examples of people using what we would consider to be cheap tricks to get into a city. For instance, dressing them up like hunters, putting hunters' clothes over their armor, having them carry a hunted boar back into the city. And as soon as they get in, they drop the boar, they take out their weapons, they kill the gatekeepers and open the gate. That sounds like a good tall tale, but it comes from a very well-documented period of history.
After the story in Homer is that the Troy is destroyed, and that's that. That's the end of Troy. You say that, in fact, archaeological evidence says that was not the end of Troy. In fact, the city was rebuilt. Maybe never what it had been, but it also wasn't destroyed forever.
Yes, in fact, that's true. But even Homer never says the city's destroyed. Homer specifically says that after Troy is sacked in the war, it will be rebuilt by Aeneas, who will become a king. There's a prophecy from Poseidon to say that. And archaeology, as you rightly say, shows that Troy was rebuilt after being destroyed. Why do we think that Troy was abandoned? Well, there are many legends and stories about Troy, and this particular one is preserved in Virgil and in his great poem, The Aeneid. It has Aeneas and the remnant of the Trojans going off to Carthage and Italy. But it's not what Homer says. And I think Homer actually gets it right in this case.
Mm. Well, as we talked about earlier, the ancient Greeks, they didn't think that this was a matter of myth. They thought that this was history, that these things had actually happened. So that for that reason, their telling of these stories would be important. After all, it also involves Greek. It does indeed involve what we would call Greek mythology, the activities of gods and so forth, and of heroes. And those things always make great stories. So to them, they were perhaps more than just stories. To us now, well, we'd say, well, it is a great story. That's why we continue to tell the story. Maybe that's that leads to this question, you know, what about this story do you think is so compelling so that it's a story that has survived? It hasn't been lost. It's continued to be told. And we essentially know this story now today.
Well, I think the most compelling thing about the story is that two great poets from the ancient world turned their talents to it, Homer and Virgil, giving us the earliest great epics in Western literary tradition, the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Aeneid. Their description of the pain and glory of war is unparalleled, and it still speaks to us today. I mean, I think that is, above all, what's so exciting and dramatic about Troy. Mm. We then get Helen, we get Achilles, we get the horse, we get Odysseus. They're just unforgettable characters. But above all, the artistry of these poets and really the heroic effort, if you think of it, of the Greeks over centuries of illiteracy and poverty, the heroic effort to remember their history in some form or other, I think, is really quite moving.
We will have to stop. We are here at the end of the time. But for people who are listening, you can read more if you look for Barry Strauss's new book. It's The Trojan War, A New History. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. You also might, if you're interested in warfare in the ancient world, you might also take a look at his book, The Battle of Salamis, about perhaps the most famous naval battle of the ancient world. He's professor of history and classics at Cornell University. Professor Strauss, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been great.
We also want to say thanks to the folks there at the Cornell University Press Office and the engineer there, Bert Reed. Focus 580, our show, is made possible in part by a grant from Body Work Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Body Work has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. Programming here is also made possible by a grant from Silver Creek Restaurant, 402 North Race in Urbana, offering fine dining for lunch and dinner in an historic Urbana setting that includes a greenhouse dining room. Silver Creek offers a 15-minute lunch guarantee and extensive Sunday brunch from 10:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Sunday. More information, call 328-3402. We're going to take a break, as we usually do. We'll be back with more Focus after news and an update on the markets.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where it appears that light spreading is going on today in the corn pit at the Chicago Board of Trade. The December contract at 274 is up 2.25. You go out to the deferred contracts, July is down 3/4. The December red line is down 3.75. The March is down 3.75 as well, make it now 3.25. So some spread trade going on there, maybe a continuation of the spread trade theme from yesterday in the wheat market, where December wheat now trading 470 up 6, while you go